The following is a recording of the final session from Brian McLean's Sunday School class for St. Mark Reformed Church in the spring of 2021, entitled A Theological Interpretation of American History, closely based on the book of the same title by Greg Singer. Due to an audio hardware malfunction, the first several minutes of this session were not recorded. But to bring the listener up to speed, Brian started out with a brief review of material from the early chapters of the book, including a review of Puritanism and the generally orthodox Christian influences which were present during the period of America's founding. From there, he went on to a review of the influences of both theism and transcendentalism, and it was during the discussion of this latter movement that the recording picks up.
The trees, and God is in the water, and God is in here, you know, wherever this may be. You know, like, I am a little bit of God myself. And of course, we got, you know, the authors, Thoreau, you know, we talked about them a little bit, the transcendentalists. From there, we get what came next? Unitarianism. Unitarianism was basically an amalgam of transcendentalism and deism sort of put together. Unitarianism is kind of hard to nail down because it's shifted so much over the years, and what we consider Unitarianism today is not the Unitarianism of then, but they were basically... theologically, Unitarians denied the Trinity. They denied the deity of Jesus Christ. So there is where you get your first big theological shift of, you know, the liberalism sort of coming in. Before that, you did have guys like Thomas Jefferson who were ripping out the supernatural parts of the Bible and whatnot. But now you're getting a whole new theology that sort of, penetrating into our culture. And of course, as we said, all these things are not necessarily just inherent to America. They began overseas, but we get an American flavor of it, because in America we have this individualism, this sort of self-made man. You know, our country is sort of founded on these ideals of you working hard and striving to make yourself independent and great. And so the theology sort of changes as it moves from Europe over to America. Next, we studied what? Puritanism, deism, transcendentalism, Unitarianism, and then Darwinism. Oh, Darwinism. Give me a definition. Students in the back. Yeah, so basically Darwinism was this understanding that, you know, the world happens by chance. So at this point now you're getting rid of the creator. So you have a sovereign God over creation. Then you have a God who is subject to his creation. Then you have a God who is just part of creation. And then you now have a God who doesn't really even exist. He could exist. Remember, we talked about theistic evolution and this idea that God sort of kick-started the world through evolution and uses evolution. But basically, Darwinism is this understanding that God didn't create, that these things happened by chance. And of course, we got a couple of different flavors of Darwinism during this time. You get the survival of the fittest understanding. And that was, we talked about William Sumner, and that was sort of, he was the American champion of that. And that's where you get a lot of the Carnegies, Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, this understanding that might makes right. And so they understood that they were in a survival of the fittest mindset. Those who are the strongest get to dictate how the world goes. And so these guys use that as they were, you know, exerting their power and by, you know, and in some ways doing some good things, but in also other ways promoting this understanding of Darwinism. Then you had a sort of counter to that that was Malorianism, and that is sort of an evolutionary optimism. And the understanding there was that, oh, this is horrible, like this survival of the fittest. Like that, we can't live this way. We can't have might makes right, but we don't want to recognize that God is in control. And so what you get is sort of this understanding of that man is still evolves, but we can dictate how that evolution happens through education. And this was Lester Ward was the American proponent of this. And so this understanding then that man is a product of his surroundings and nature. So if we just tweak things just right, if we just give him the right amount of information, if we just guide him the way he's supposed to go, he can go in the right direction and he can evolve the right way. Of course, there's a lot of inconsistencies in that. As Christians, we understand this doesn't make sense. I mean, you can't do that. But, of course, it doesn't always, you know, these philosophies don't make sense. This is where we talked about John Dewey and the public education system came from this, and this understanding that the public education system was started so that we could train our citizens to move in the direction. And this, of course, led to the social gospel. And the social gospel is very much a evolutionary foundation. The gospel at this point is the eradication of poverty, the eradication of war, the eradication of inequality, that progress is made through human capability. Sin is institutional and can be fixed. This eventually, as we talked about, what you get is this is not true. Obviously, the rules don't change. You know, if the philosophies change, the reality doesn't change. So it can't be fixed. And so this understanding that man is inherently good is not reality. And so man is not inherently good. But they don't want to say that sin, you know, the depravity of man, and again, total depravity is not necessarily that man is as bad as he can be, but it's this understanding that sin affects every area of our life. And if you deny that, you're not, you know, what are you going to do with the fact that men do bad things? And even education, as we've shown, does not help. So what happens is you have to have somebody enforce this. So when you get eradication of sin or of this understanding of the sin nature of man, original sin, you know, you even see this in the Catholic Church. I mean, for instance, you get this, they have to have a pope in order to make things work. You have to have a sovereign God in some way, and so they have a pope. Of course, in the social gospel, who is the God? Who is the person that became the God for them? Because they needed somebody, huh? Yeah, the government. The government, the state becomes the God. The state becomes the one that has to enforce these ideals. The state is the one that says, okay, you can't do these things over here because it's not good for man or for our civilization or society, so you must adhere this way. And so here, the way they enforce that is through regulation. The way they enforce that is through certain laws. And again, not all laws are bad, but, you know, once the ball got rolling, it never stopped. And we see that today, laws for every little thing, regulating every little thing. Now, when we're talking about liberalism, we go back to the 1800s, and there was still this seed of morality that's there. You know, remember, they were very much pro-family. They still had this understanding of morality that still was seeping into their life from, you know, going back to the Puritan ideals. You know, remember, even like, what's it called? No drinking. Prohibition. Even something like prohibition was this understanding that, look, these people are getting drunk. They're not serving society well. They're doing bad things. And so we need to stop this. And again, prohibition was not a good thing. But what was behind it was sort of this understanding of, oh, hey, we need to somehow fix this because it's not good for these people to be doing this. And of course, that evolved further when you start talking about inequality, and you start talking about some of the, you know, the as the left has sort of created their new gospel, there is a new, you know, there's a new salvation that comes with it, right? There's new sins out there that have to be fixed. You have to have a new salvation. So, again, the theological liberalism is very much in line with political democracy and this understanding that our society and its good and ills are all dependent on man. And again, in a democratic society, who gets to decide what's the best for society? The majority. So whoever, again, so whoever votes, you know, and the majority decides, okay, this is what is true. This is what is actual for your society. This is what will make you better. Of course, the irony of democracy, which is of the people, as conceived by the founding fathers, to today, where democracy means it's subject to totalitarianism. I think I didn't read that. Anyway, basically what I'm saying is this ironic. If you go back to what Thomas Jefferson meant by democracy and what democracy is today, it's not, you know, like Thomas Jefferson would be, you know, rolling around in his grave if he knew what America looked like today. But, you know, I talked about this with Puritanism a little bit, but I'll just sort of wrap up our you know, come back to the beginning. It's the understanding of true liberty that that we can be free can only come by, you know, again, this it's ironic. It's you have to submit yourself to a sovereign God if you want to be free. And liberalism ultimately then is just a rejection of wanting to, you know, they don't want to submit to a sovereign God. And that ultimately is the story of the Bible too. I mean, those that reject God is just a not wanting to submit. We don't. I want to be my own person. I don't want to submit. But the reality is that true freedom comes from that submission. I want to read. So this is a little bit of a long passage, but this is sort of his summary of this, and I think it's really good. And I'll try to read when I've read passages before. Sometimes I feel like they get kind of jumbled up because of the language, but I'll try to read it. So it's 334, the final paragraph, if you're following along. Like I said, this is going to be a little bit long, but I'll try to read it slow and just sort of emphasize the key parts here. Because I just think it's really good what he writes and sort of sums up, especially in relation to this understanding that true freedom comes through submission to God. He says this: thus, the final contribution of theological liberalism to the present dilemma confronting the American people. So again, this understanding that theology affects the culture. This has been an impetus toward the totalitarian type of government in which an economic collectivism, socialism, for instance, becomes the order of the day. So he's talking about the irony here of the fact that this understanding of democracy has led to totalitarianism. It would certainly seem ironical at first glance that a theology which sought to emancipate man from the clutches of a sovereign God And a political philosophy which placed such a high value on human freedom and dignity should join in a subtle conspiracy to bring political freedom to an end in this country in the name of democracy. Yet this is exactly what has happened. And while it may seem incongruous at first glance, this is not the case. The final negation of freedom in the name of democracy is the logical and almost necessary outcome of the rejection of the biblical insistence on the sovereignty of God. In its rejection of the sovereignty of God, liberalism was committing itself to a doctrine of abject slavery for the whole human race and was severing itself from the source of all freedom, namely God himself. This is the essential failure of all those philosophies of freedom which seek this precious commodity elsewhere than in man's subjection to the righteous and holy will of God. In rejecting Calvinism, the liberals were, in effect, denying the only true source of human freedom, political, social, and economic. And in their alliance with the secular democratic philosophy, they were setting the stage for the disappearance of that freedom, which had been safeguarded by the Puritan political tradition and the Constitution. And remember, we talked about the fact that, you know, we had this Constitution, 1787, that has, over the years, become fluid. I mean, the debates we have now about what the Constitution is meant to do is nothing new. I mean, we talked about how, going back to the 1800s, they were already arguing, you know, beginning to argue like the 1850s, the 1860s. Remember, Oliver Wendell Holmes came to the Supreme Court, and one of the first things he said was that we need to revamp the Constitution, that it's just not working for today. We need something new. The willingness of modern liberalism, both theological and political, to come to terms with totalitarianism and collectivism, again, socialism, this, as that form of freedom most compatible with the needs of 20th century man, is a tragic commentary on the intellectual and moral emptiness of these philosophies. When theology rejected the scriptures as the norm of all truth and accepted the dictum that man is the measure, there was little left but to accept the idea that in democracy, the expressed will of the majority, there is the norm by which all truth is measured. Man is the measure. And of course, you know, you see the problem with that, because it's not a objective truth. It's subjective truth. And then what is right? You know, we did recently go through a period where it was, you know, the call of the day was, you know, let me be in charge of my own. So my values, my truth. Remember how the, you know, gay marriage, you know, they told us that this is not, why do you even care? It doesn't affect you. It has nothing to do with you. Just let us do our thing. You do your thing and let us all live together in harmony. 15 years later, we see that that is not the case. Now they are imposing rules and values and laws upon us that your desire to just live peaceably on your own is not good enough for them. So, collective man, did I read that? Collective man thus becomes the measure of political truth, or rather political expediency, and collectivism takes over in the economic, social, and political life of the state, which is dedicated to this philosophy. This is the last line. A totalitarian state, virtually infallible. And again, it has to be infallible. You have to have that. Just like a pope, you have to have somebody that says this is the way it is, and they're right. Otherwise, you have chaos. Of course, this the different. We have a sovereign God, and what they have is a totalitarian state. It becomes as necessary in a democratic society as an infallible papacy is for a church which rejected the scriptures as the only rule of faith and practice. So again, if you start adding other things as the way that you understand truth, you're going to have somebody stand there and say, okay, put their foot down and say, you must abide by this. And that's what the state does. So what is the answer? He says, okay, he basically has one page, you know, this whole book, and then it's like, okay, what's the answer? And then he gives you one little page. But I will, and of course that's not it. I mean, there's other books written for this. But I do think he does give a good answer. And again, I'm not going to read this whole thing. I'll just read excerpts. But again, I am going to read because I think it is good. And I think there's some good stuff here. And, you know, it's his book that we've been reading. So I'll let him have the last word. So he says this: the answer is found in the biblical view of government. And he says this: Christian theism insists that government was ordained by God for man, and that its just powers come from him and not from man. Government is not ordained primarily to defend human liberty. And this is key. So listen to this. Government is not ordained primarily to defend human liberty, Again, that sounds weird to our ears, but he's listen again, because this is what we think government does. Government is not ordained primarily to defend human liberty, but to ensure that that kind of society necessary for man to carry out those duties which he owes to God alone. Thus, government has clearly defined powers and operates in a clearly defined sphere. And this takes us back to what we were learning from the Puritans, was this understanding that the government's job is to not just dictate how we should live, but their job is to protect these liberties, that, you know, protect the church, to protect the morality, the teachings of God, the truth, the God's word that actually does the affecting. The truth, the freedom that comes in a society can only come through God's word. The government's job is to protect that, to make sure that that can happen. You know, it's not, and that's a key thing. I mean, like you can make the argument. I mean, you could flat out, you could say in a broad stroke that government is supposed to defend our liberties, and there is some essence of truth of that. But then ultimately, you dig down, and how do they do that? Like, how are they supposed to do that? Well, his argument is primarily is that they're supposed to protect our religious freedom, so that we can freely worship God, and, you know, see a community and ultimately a society grow through the instruction of God's word, through worship, through gathering for worship. Let me read a couple of little lines here. When human government, so again, he's talking about the overreach here. When human government enters into the field of labor relations, education, mental and physical health, agriculture, housing, and those many other areas of legislation so characteristic of the federal government today, it leaves its proper functions and enters into those areas of life which God has either ordained that the church or the family should have as their particular sphere of responsibility. So we didn't really ever go into this, and some of you are familiar with this understanding of sphere sovereignty. You know, you have the family, you have government, you have the church. Well, the government creeps into all of those and is dictating the family. It dictates how the church, you know, we're seeing this today, you know, and they're dictating how you can worship, when you can worship, whether you can worship or not. That's not their role. You have to put your foot down. And some people complain and say, well, what's the big deal? You know, why can't you just do, you know? No, the point is that you can't let the government tell you what to do, because it's not their realm. They can't do that. They're not supposed to do that. I got a little inspired last night when our friends from Tennessee Stands come over, and she's actually working in the realm of the public school, which, you know, on the one hand, I'm just kind of like, you know, but she is so passionate about refusing to let the government dictate what the children, you know, and I mean, she was tears. I mean, she's just passionate. She's like, pray for us. Like, we have a big thing coming up where and she goes in there and she doesn't say, let's compromise or let's talk. She's like, this is not your realm. She's like, they don't even want to mess with her, because she goes in there and says, you are overstepping your bounds and you need to stop, and you're not allowed to do this. And, you know, and it's pretty funny because it's the public school that she's doing it with, and I don't know how far she's going to get, but, you know, that's the type of attitude you have to have, though. You have to say, no, you can't come in here. I'd love that video of that Canadian pastor that just says, get out of my church, you know, and he's just telling them, like, you have no place here. You are wicked. Get out. You're overstepping your bounds. Get away. Gestapo, you know, you can't come in here. And that's great. That's really what you have to do. Of course, you know, that's what needed to be done, you know, centuries ago. And of course, you know, it's much harder to do that now because of how far and how deep it's gotten. Let me finish up. The real problem then is not basically the reduction of governmental expenses. Okay, so again, we can sit here and he's going to talk about some of the things that we talk about. Okay, there's too much spending there. But the real problem then is not reducing government spending, as important as that is, nor the proper relationship between the state and federal government, or the victory over one political party over another. And all of these have their place. But the basic issue is the reduction of the total scope of government on both the federal and state level to those spheres which are clearly conferred upon it by the scriptures. So they must get back to where they belong. which liberal political philosophy and practice have given to it during the last 100 years or so. Only then will our government be truly Christian and freedom will be restored to its former and proper place in the life of the American people. The end. So that's how he ends it. Again, we could sit here. I mean, it sounds great, and yeah, but then it's sort of this, what do we do? How do we do that? How could you get to that point? And I don't know that if we want to sing, then we probably well, you know what? This is one way you do it. This is one way you do it. So, you know, what we are doing here, gathering for worship, learning to sing psalms, because psalms are the way that we fight. If I had time, and we don't, I had this article that I pulled up that I searched for last week, and it was way longer than I thought it was. But so I can't just, you know, pick and choose some aspects. But basically, it's an old Jim Jordan article about sort of the way our societies go, and they move from tribalism to nationalism, and they're sort of the, you remember I talked about how it's not just a circle, it's not a cycle, it's actually rolling, but it's rolling left. You're left, so it'd be going. So it's actually there is a cyclical aspect to history, but it's going, it's moving in a particular direction. And Jim Jordan sort of talks about that in terms of moving from tribalism to nationalism. And when he gave this talk, he said that I think we're moving back to tribalism again. And of course, we really do see that nowadays. Again, this is another ask. If you only knew, you know, and I think this was written in the 90s maybe. But he does talk about that one of the aspects of tribalism and original tribalism. So you're talking about literal tribes. That Western civilization came and changed. You know, Christianity changed the world. And one of the ways it changed is it took tribalism and turned it into community. It changed it. And so, but one of the aspects he said was that in tribalism, there is no, what does he say? A division of labor. You only need warriors. Women are there to have the babies. Men are warriors. If you can't fight, then you're put to death. Some people, you know, we're talking extreme tribalism here, you know, the Incas, the Aztecs, and, you know, even in America, some of them were literally bred for food to the gods. You know, this is the worlds that tribalism was, that Christianity came into and changed. Christianity brought in a division of labor, but there is still aspects of tribalism that are true. And one of the aspects is that we truly are all warriors. You know, as we have matured as a society and as we mature in Christian society, we do take on division of labor. We do mature and we do grow. But there's a Christian aspect of tribalism that we are all warriors. We all fight. But we don't fight in the military in that way. You know, that's not what we do. We do fight, though, through singing, through prayer, through worship. And so there is an aspect of that, and I'd love to, maybe at some point in the future we can talk more about this and I can maybe make it into a Sunday school lesson a little bit better, but because it's fantastic stuff. But I do think as we lead into this next point that TJ is going to come up here and take over, we're going to sing Psalm 148, and that is how we fight. That's one way we fight. So thanks. This was fun. I learned a lot doing it. And I'm thankful for everybody that showed up. It was great. I mean, this is fantastic that everybody was coming every week. So thanks.